how do we rule according to which opinion? He looked at me with a piercing look and said in his inimitable accent, who are we? Who are we? I mean, how do we pass it? Who do we mean we? Do we mean this? Do we mean the Rambam? Do we mean the Shulchan Aruch? Do we mean the Rambam? Who are we? When we say who are we winning, I want to know who are we? We think about whether we are winning, we have to think of ourselves first. How do we, I mean, how do we pass it? Who do we mean we? Do we mean this? Do we mean the Rambam? Do we mean the Shulchan Aruch? Oh, who's we? When we say who are we winning, I want to know who are we? We think about whether we are winning, we have to think of ourselves first. How do we fit in to the events of Hanukkah? Are we to be understood as individuals? Follow the footsteps of those who fought military battles, which are recounted in the Al Hanisim. The difficult question to answer, are we winning? Those victories disappeared with the destruction of the second base of Mikdash. As a matter of fact, the Gemara tells us that we really shouldn't be celebrating Hanukkah anymore. All the other celebrations of particular victories during the second Beis HaMikdash is but long Megillas Tanis. There's no longer any celebration, because if we won the battle, we subsequently lost the war. And the reason why Hanukkah is unique is because of the miracle of the Neros, of the Menorah, which took place in the Beis HaMikdash. So we have to win. So, if we're referring to military battles, we're no longer winning. That victory ceased to exist with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. However, one can also interpret, as Rabbi Barak said, that the victory was the victory of Torah. The Torah continues to exist until Torah is not forgotten. If that's the case, then anybody who studies Torah is still winning. Because it was a battle which was intended to make us forget Torah completely, but by definition, anyone who ever studies any Torah is still winning. But I believe that that is not a complete victory. As important as that victory is, we don't belittle it for a moment. However, I feel that the question is still open. Hanukkah, are we still winning? We have to look back at the events of Hanukkah and compare them to events in our own time. As was mentioned, Hanukkah involved the story of a clash of cultures. The culture of Greece, or by the Greek non-Jews, or by the Hellenist Jews who were influenced by Greeks, on the one hand, and on the other hand, Torah, pristine, pure Torah, the work of God and the divine. As long as these two cultures remain completely apart from one another, an individual who is studying Torah is undoubtedly still winning, in the sense that his Torah remains pure. However, I dare say that most of us sitting in the room today are not only influenced by Torah, but are also influenced, whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not, by the secular culture. Here is the key question. Are we still winning when we interact not only with the word of Torah, but with the word of secular culture? Of the culture of today, are we emerging victorious as the Chashmonaim did? The Chashmonaim were those who were able to maintain the truth of Torah while being exposed to Greek culture, or we lose it, as the Hellenists did, being bowled over by the culture which was so popular at its time, and failing to recognize the importance of the Torah legacy. At first glance, this question shouldn't even be raised. Just simply say, we have no right to relate to the secular culture of today whatsoever. We must enclose ourselves completely within the very limited framework of Torah, and thereby we can emerge victorious. There are many who have in fact adopted that position, more powerful than them, they have been very largely successful. But, as I said earlier, the audience which I addressed this evening is not leading to the lifestyle. We're not talking to people who are removed completely from matters of this world, from the language, from the culture, from the society. And therefore we are challenged day in and day out with the challenge which faced the Chashmonaim so many years ago. And indeed, there can be justification for inclusion of certain elements of the secular culture within the framework of Torah. Rabbi that taught us, and the pasuk we read recently, Yah Elokim Liyepes, the Yishkon Liol Hashem, God recognizes the beauty of Yepes, Yepes from the Greek culture, it's not limited to Greece proper, but the culture which is similar to the Greek culture, the Yishkon Liol Hashem. Yes, it has a place in the Ol of Shem, in the Yeshiva, and the Mokom Torah. It has a place. The question, of course, becomes, how do we balance the Yafiyafu social Yepes, the duty of Yepes of Greece within the Ol of Shem, and hence of Shem, of the Beis HaMedrash of the Yeshiva. I claim that many of us are failing this test on two grounds. But perhaps we are no longer winning in this battle. Number one, remember, Yafiyafu social shame shall yet us at the place of all the shame. The beauty of the culture of Greece will call it America as a place in the tents of shame. It's a limiting descriptive term. The Yafiyafu social yes. The beauty of Greece or America has place in all the shame. But there are parts of the Greek and now American culture which are very far from beautiful. Which are in fact the result of perversion. Which are manifestations of immorality. Do these have a place in the tent of shame? Do these have a place in our Beis HaMedrash, in our yeshivas, in our shuls, in our way of looking at things? The answer must be a resounding no. And unfortunately, there are those, even in the Torah camp, who don't recognize that so much of culture today, American culture, doesn't even qualify for the term Yafiyafu social yefes. It's not beautiful at all. Rather, it's immoral, and therefore, from our perspective, it's ugly. And ugliness of Yepes has no place in the Ol of Shem. Now, whether ugliness refers to the immorality which exists in American society, which we have very great difficulty escaping, it's right in front of us. Open a newspaper. Just put on the news of the radio. You hear in the headlines every perversion. Some of it being viewed as criminal. Some of it being viewed as an alternative lifestyle. Some of it being viewed as completely acceptable. Mainstream. All of which are way of looking at things are very far Yafiyafu social yefes. These are ugliness. Yes, by the way, as ugly as it existed in Greek society as well. Just those who know about the great Greek philosophers and study a little bit beneath the surface about their biographies, you will note that many of the perversions today are not new. They were glorified, sanctioned by these icons of Greek philosophy and culture. Many of us failed this first test. The attempt to take the entirety of American culture and somehow subsume it under the general banner of Torah, it just doesn't work. Something that's beyond the pale. You must be very straightforward about what is and what is not accepted. Number two, let's focus for a moment on the Akifu social yet. On the good parts of American culture. Yes, there probably are still some good parts. If not the culture in the generally understood meaning of that term, there's the science, which we still accept and applaud and benefit from in so many ways. There is government, there is the military, so many aspects of general life which we appreciate, which have a place in the Torah way of thinking. But, in the second point of some of those there, you have to recognize and understand that the beauty of all of these accomplishments are to be understood by looking from the perspective of Torah. Yishkon be all a shame, beauty can exist in the tent of Torah, the Beis HaMedrash, in a yeshiva, in a shul, in a Mokum Torah. We can appreciate what goes on in the outside world. We can train our children and give them a secular education. Perhaps it will enable them to earn a livelihood. Perhaps it will enable them to engage in intelligent conversation with members outside the Torah camp. Have many beneficial effects. But these effects are beneficial only when they're viewed in that perspective. The Rambam, who spent a great deal of time analyzing the secular culture of his day, described these secular accomplishments of his, philosophy, medicine, etc., as handmaids, cooks, bakers. That's a phrase he used in a celebrated responsa. He was criticized for his secular studies. He said, I'm telling you, he swore by God's name, that these are the rakokos and the tabokos and the okos. These are the shetokos. These are the maidservants. And who is the central point? This is the Torah. Yaakov gave the efforts, yes, there was certainly place for the beauty of the secular culture, not its ugliness. But that place is for all their shame if a person understands the central and focal point of the Torah. Indeed, this is the theme of the menorah we are taught. And mul panei ha-menorah yishev ha-saneros. Candles are facing towards the middle of the menorah. As been explained by many of the Mephoroshim, the seven light, and we have the seven chokmos, the seven signs and disciplines. And we accept them. We admire their light. But only when the light is focused towards the middle, which represents Torah. So, all we winning, militarily, that victory, long gone. Have we maintained the existence of Torah? Decidedly yes. But I believe the main question is, how are we confronting the secular culture today as compared with how the brave Hashem Noam did so many years ago? And here, the jury is still out. Are we able to separate beauty from ugliness? And are we able to put the beauty in its proper perspective? These are questions we face day in and day out. Individuals want to know, what should their relationship be to television, radio, magazines, secular culture, advertising, shopping, the outside world? So many day in and day out decisions we have to make. And these decisions will determine whether in fact they're living or not. So as we prepare ourselves for Hanukkah, let us put it in the proper perspective. Some years back, celebrated Israeli journalist, newspaper Ma'arib, like the New York Times, wrote an article in which he described the fact that Hanukkah is such a universally celebrated holiday in the state of Israel. And he pointed out that many of the secularists they would stop and think for a moment about what they're celebrating, they would realize that they're really rooting for the wrong team. Had they, with their present thoughts, been around in those days, they would have been on the helpless side, not on the side of the Hashmonah. But they celebrate a national holiday. A national holiday, it's not a menorah, and they put up a sign, have a party. Are we still winning? Are we secularists? Are we modern-day Hellenists? Are we too tolerant of the perversion of society? Do we equate secular achievement with Torah? If the answer is yes to those questions, we're not winning. If the answer is that we recognize secular society and culture, we benefit from it, we appreciate it, the beautiful parts of it, and put it in proper perspective, being something which is secondary to the privacy of Torah, then in fact, we are winning while being involved in the outside world. I hope that my few words this evening will enable us to make this year's celebration of Hanukkah a great victory.
Tells us that the whole miracle of Hanukkah brought about as a result of tshuva. And tshuva in a very particular area. That the loss of the korban hatamid, the potential sacrifice, and with it, the loss of the light, the menorah which burned in the Beis HaMikdash, the symbol of perpetuity, were themselves the result of a kind of a laxity, a loss of passionate interest in the Avodas Beis HaMikdash itself. In this particular aspect of worship, this particular leg of the three-legged stool of Torah of Avodah and Mikdash HaSodim, rushed to Avodah. It became weak, lazy, lax in the service of God, Avodah Hashem. When suddenly the lights went out, quite literally, Korban HaTamid was stopped. There was a terrible soul searching and a terrible panic. And in the Mesiras Nefesh, surrounded the effort to re-enter, to purify, and to rekindle the lights of the Beis HaMikdash, a special reward was given by God. The reward of the Pashemen, the possibility of relighting the lamp. Avodah was returned, and Rambam concludes, it is for this reason that Hanukkah is designated as a day characterized the Hodos of the Halit, to give thanks to God and to sing praise. The Hodos of the Halit are not merely responses, generic responses to miracle. In this case, they are in a sense a recreation of the miracle itself. The miracle is that phenomenon known as Avodah, the dialogue between man and God. And the Hodos Ulahaleo is to engage in Avodah Shebaleh and to stress its continuity with the Avodah of the Korban Tamid and of the menorah, the light, the Ner Tamid in the Beis HaMikdash. So Hanukkah is a festival of the continuity of Avodah. Choice of symbol. If indeed this were all we were concerned with, then it would be puzzling to explain the precise choice of the Neros as the central concrete symbol. Because if we're talking in general about the resurrection of Avodah, then we should have sufficed with the Avodah of Halach. This, the Maram, is not explicitly explained. Perhaps I might offer a suggestion. Let us understand what the Avodah and the Beis HaMikdash meant. The Beis HaMikdash was a place where the rules of nature seem in certain key ways to have been suspended. We heard to, of course, in the famous Mishnah, the fifth chapter of Avos, Asara Nisi Nasu Lavoseinu, 10 miracles constantly attended the function of the Beis HaMikdash. And the Mishnah gives a number of examples that the odor of rotting meat had no deleterious impact on pregnant women. Indeed, none of the sacrificial meat ever spoiled. There was no fly in the slaughterhouse. These symbols of a different law of nature mean a particular taste of a particular living is paid for with a bit of dying. Each of us, Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam, the human spirit is a candle, and for each moment we live in this world, we die a little. We start dying a little when we are born. And life, living, becomes synonymous with that death. That is the fate of all organic creatures. And according to Chazal, that sad reality was not what the Ribbono Shel Olam intended for his beautiful world. This essential mortality, the mortality of existence itself, was not to be a part of the Bias HaOlam. The nature was a birth without death, a living without dying. And then came the Chet, and the new order, or rather a new disorder. It's a Mikdash with its fires that didn't go out, with its meat that never spoiled, represented symbolically an island where man could partake of the universe according to its original pattern. Partake of a sweetness unalloyed by the ticking meter of the angel of death in his unfolding progress to collect us. The moment of Avodah was a moment to be raised above those rules. This sense of Mikdash, the essence of Avodah, was when the Beis HaMikdash was built, indeed when the Mishkan was built, already an experience which had a history. What is our moment of Avodah? Most precisely, Avodah Shel Olam is Tefillah. The Tefillah par excellence is Shemun Esrei, and perhaps the paragraph which most vividly captures what it is that Tefillah is itself is the first, which perhaps we should reread. The drama describes the drama of reading the words Baruch Atah, of addressing the Eibushne as you in the familiar second person, and then suddenly to be arrested when we come to the word Hashem, the Yud Kei Vav Kei, the tenseless one who is at one moment past and present and future, because by definition, for him, no clock is ticking. Suddenly, mortal man is called to realize with what force he almost shook hands. Who was this Atah, whom we so casually began to address? That moment when suddenly the ground beneath our feet disappears and we hurtle through space in the realization that we have been brought into the presence, the concept of timelessness, of tenselessness, that we've been touched by something beyond, followed by the phrase that we are to remember that we are not the first who stood in that place. That phrase, as it first appears, is intended to catapult us to a moment when someone else stood in the realization that this world, with a living which is always dying, has above it, beyond it, and held within it is potential. potential a better world. That was the vision of Moshe Rabbeinu when he saw the bush burning in fire. And he wasn't consumed. Here was a light, a heat, a glow, and no substance was paying for it with its death. There was no combustion of matter. No beautiful green tree was being turned to ash so that the world might have a moment of light. No neshama was hurtling toward the grave so that there might be a moment of life. Moshe Rabbeinu saw this. This was avoda, to look into the fire that burns without destroying, the life which throbs without death at its center. That's what Moshe saw in the fire. And even as he saw it, he understood Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, that my fire has a history. This must have been what the Avos meant when they went to embrace the Melech Chofetz B'Chaim. Chofetz B'Chaim means real Chaim. Not the Chaim of biology, which is also modest, but the real Chaim. Transfixed by a Masorah which can only be understood by one who has experienced it himself. Up to then, Moshe couldn't say who was the Elokeinu Velokei Avoseinu. He couldn't really say it because he hadn't seen the fire. When Moshe built his Mishkan, which became the Beis HaMikdash, it was this fire, the fire in which Moshe saw the Avos, the fire in which the Avos saw Maaseh Bereishis, the implicit perfectibility of the universe for which the Ribono Shel Olam created it and is waiting to return it. Moshe planted that fire in the Mikdash. Lahalos ner tomid. So that this notion of that which does not go out, the life which has no death, might be accessible to Am Yisrael. Perhaps not. All the time. But when moment will come and we deserve to look into a different place, a different life, and understand the world has in its heart hopefulness, possibility, takes away the sadness which hangs like a pall from all that we do. To have been in that place before that fire is the greatest taluk that a human spirit can know. It is what gives us strength to do what we must do to make that world perfect, because we see a moment of what it is we're working for. Avoda, the real Avoda Shebaleid. The Avoda Shebaleid is a glimpse into the fire. The fire that works by the other set of rules. What happened in the Beis HaMikdash? What happened in the era of Yovan? Yovan, for the first time, pose a threat to the Torah, which was unexampled. For till that time, other nations of the region, the Jew had been asked to choose between his higher self and his lower self. We know the morality of the Canaanite worship. Again and again, man was told, "We know who you are. You are a person. You are a creature defined by your lusts. Why pretend? Come and take hold of your essential self." Greeks came with a different thing. The Greeks competed for the higher man. For the first time, the threat was, we have something which is everything the Torah was, and more, a more sophisticated, more ethical, more wise system. For the first time, the Torah was threatened by something which claimed to be more like the Torah than the Torah, which claimed to be the New Year's model facing an old Model T. Or Toyota. I just thought that was not nice. That's why you come to these things so you can hear the new material first. All of a sudden, it was as if this was the world. And that fire couldn't do anything. Great gasp between Ketorah and Hashem. The heart that could look into the fire and see Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, that could be with Moshe at the snare. It was as if that heart had died. That it was not a world in which worship was any longer possible. It was as if the oxygen had been taken away from the fire of the snare. Because the snare didn't need to burn wood, and it didn't need to burn gas. It was the avoda shel halev, but it did need a lathe to burn. Rachmana liba boy. For God to be in this world, there had to be a heart, not as Conrad would say, a heart of darkness, but a heart of light, which could see that this was a different kind of fire, a different hope, a different place. And it was as if, in the threat of Yavon, that heart could no longer exist. And so there would be no heart of light and no fire. And no avoda. But the Neis Chanukah proved to us that there is something in the Jewish heart which cannot be affected by any kind of sophistication. There is some essential power and yearning in the Jewish heart that when they turned off the fire, people who thought that they were beyond that suddenly panicked, were stricken by the willingness to be Moseh Nefesh, to give their very lives, to have their Mikdash back. Mikdash as defined as the place of the Nair, Mikdash as the locus of fire. There was suddenly the yearning, and before a single arrow flew, before the menorah was lit, the miracle had already taken became the divine symbol. But there would always be room between Atah and Hashem. Forever and for all generations, for every Jew to stand by the snare and say, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Look into the candle. Even in that age of great sophistication, the rules of nature would be set aside. Beyond the limits of all of its fuel, fire would burn, fire of light that was not death, fire of hope that did not, by definition, include destruction, and that it would be possible. The real challenge of the challenge of the Hodos Ulahal. The Hodos Ulahal to see if when we look into the lights of the menorah, feel fire in us, whether we still have the sun, whether we are still creatures of Avoda Shevaleit, and whether the Mikdash in that sense is still alive in all of us. I guess I could ask Rabbi Willick's question again, question of the night, are we winning? No question of all of the areas of Yiddishkeit. In God, the world has more learning in it than it's had in a long time. There are all kinds of vehicles, the chesed. Still having trouble with Avodah Shevaleit. Still having trouble with real worship. With the fire, the snare, the break between Atah and Hashem. Is not really the question, are we winning? The assurance that we will win. That there have been generations before, which people thought were generically inhospitable, the human spirit raising itself above the organic condition. And in those days, we won. God's help. The hearts in us are the same hearts. Okay, we will okay Allah Sayyid, we'll okay Abraham, we'll okay Yitzchak, we'll okay Yaakov. The hearts of our fathers and of our mothers are the same hearts. They will be the fuel for us.
Begin by expressing my very deep gratitude to Rabbi Berish for inviting me to come back to Riverdale again and speak to some of my closest friends that I made there in the 8 years that I lived there with my family. I wondered many times when I sat in the audience of such gatherings here in Riverdale, what it felt like to be the third speaker after two master orators developed such beautiful themes on the same subject matter. Now I know what it feels like. Remember, my uncle once told me at a bar mitzvah when he was scheduled to speak last, he told me over a mitzvah with the Rav, who was going to visit a city to try out to get the position of rabbi in that shul, the main shul of the city. And the same week, they had another rabbi coming. And they both would speak, one before Lehi, one before Etel Kenyu. So the two rabbis came to the city and they stayed, they put them up in the same hotel. And one of them was chazing over his drosha, back and forth pacing, chazing over his drosha. And the rabbi next door, he can only hear what the rabbi is saying. And he starts listening to somebody else first. Can I speak ahead of the other one? He gets up to speak after the kriya, and he sends over the exact drosha the other rabbi prepared. This is prepared such a drosha. What's he going to say now? He gets up after Musa and tells the city the following. He says, you know, you called me here to be sick.
The beautiful thought, which I
saw from a Gedalia Shor, which explains a Mishnah in the Sefer Midos. Mishnah Yidah says that on the Har Abayit, where the Beis HaMikdash was built upon, there was a small latticework, a fence, called the Seirim, 10 Tvachim high, which surrounded the Har Abayit. And there's a difference of opinion as to what was the purpose of this Seirim. The Rosh explains that it was meant to make the Har Abayit a Rishus HaYavim. It was a wall that was 10 Tvachim high, surrounding the Har Abayit, it created Rishus HaYavim. The Tosfos Yavam says it served as a boundary to tell the Gentiles who would bring korbanos until here and further you may not go. The Mishnah in Midos tells us, Vishloish esrei protzois hoiboi shepotsum malchei yavam. Malchei yavam came and they broke through this survey. They smashed, they made 13 holes in this survey. The symbolism of the 13 I'm not going to go into. You get the long arrears on that, explaining that it's the first of the Yud Gimel Kiyos on the Kodesh Baruch. But we'll just discuss the very fact that they broke through this siren. And according to each chat, he explains what Yavam was doing. And when we say that this is the thought of Yavam, not necessarily with every Gentile soldier who hammered through the siren, thinking that with what I'm doing here is symbolically a breakage of the Beis HaMikdash. He may have not thought that, but up in Shemayim, where the battle was being played out in the heavenly spheres, the battle was being made to break that Rishus HaYavim. The Seirim represented the Rishus HaYavim of Beis HaMikdash. It is the one Beis HaMikdash of the Bnei Yisrael. It is the central point where Kadosh Baruch Hu resides amongst his nation, Bnei Yisrael. Elokei Yisrael. We are the Am HaYisrael. We are different than the other nations of the world. And the Yavonim said, no, there's no Rishus HaYavim here. Break open the fence. Allow Yavonim to come into the Beis HaMikdash. Allow the Greek culture to mix with the Beis HaMikdash, with the Kedushas HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash is not the property of Klal Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not the property of Klal Yisrael. There's nothing special about them. And the Mishyavim followed in that thought. They also believe that, yes, let us be like the nations of the world. We're all one. There's no Rishus HaYavim. There's no Am HaYisrael. There's no other Kei Yisrael. If that is the battle of Yavam, if that is their kachas, they wish to defile by Kadosh Baruch Hu. They wish to make for Rishus HaYavim, Rishus HaRabim. And the battle of the Chashmonaim against them was to do the exact opposite. To at once take out Rishus HaYavim, fortify it. And the Mishnah goes on and says, they actually, the Godrum, they re-fortified that Sayyid. And the Gemara Yerushalmi says that it was the Chashmonaim themselves who closed it up once again. And this symbolized they fortified Rishus HaYavim of Klal Yisrael. And more so, says the Gemara Yerushalmi. The mitzvah which the Chashmonaim contributed to Klal Yisrael was the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah. What does that symbolize, Ner Chanukah? Ner Chanukah, the mitzvah when it was first created, when Chazal was first massacred to light the Neres of Chanukah, we were to take our menorah and put the Pesach that's open to Rishus HaRabim. And what was the purpose of that? That was to create, instead of taking it from the outside into Rishus HaRabim, Chassid Shalom, to allow the Tumah of Yevonim into our house, we would do the opposite. Not only did they strengthen the Rishus HaRabim of Bnei Yisrael, but they said, we're going to take that Rishus HaRabim, we're going to take the Kedusha, and we're going to filter it out into the world. We're going to spread Kedusha from our Rishus HaYavim into Rishus HaRabim, not Chassid Shalom from the opposite. I remember hearing a story from Rabbi Kell a number of years ago, that set up at a good convention. And although I think it's made its round, I'd like to share it with you. Rabbi Kell has told over a story about a businessman work together with a Gentile partner. They shared an office, they shared a business for many years. They were very friendly with each other. One day, his partner tells him sad news that his wife and he are separating, divorcing him. So his wife got the apartment, got the house. He basically doesn't have a place to stay. He asked him, maybe you know a place like a rent-out basement, a room for a few months. And the partner said, well, tell you the truth, I have a large house, I haven't had it. If you have no place to stay, you can move it temporarily for a little while. Are we happy about that? Has to work for an apartment? They moved the stuff in. And instead of looking at that, a couple of days passed. And then one day, he made his way down the steps one evening. And he came down and said, you know, I'm on the way to the drinking house. Maybe if you have something, I can have something to drink. And his wife, of this Jew, said, certainly, gave him a drink. He sat down for a minute in the living room on the couch. One of the little kids were running around, spoke to him for a couple of minutes, asked him where he was, to school, where he was studying. A few days later, he came out a couple of hours earlier than that. They started talking to a few of the children, and the children got interested. They wanted to hear what they never saw a Gentile before, really, up close. They had a chance to speak to him. And he was an interesting one. He'd been in the army, fought in Vietnam. He had things to tell them, stories to tell, and the kids went home. Father came home from work, from shul, from the shir. All the kids are sitting around this Gentile partner, with their mouth off, they're all listening to the story. They're laughing at him. He's listening to the ears. Tell God how they're going to be trained as soldiers. Not bad. I'm getting an education. A little bit about how the army is. The next day, he has a talk about how he went through college, what he majored in, what he minored in, and what this is about, and that's about, all of the stories. And days went on, and the family became so close to this fellow, it became like an evening's activity. Every night, the fellow would come down, and now he was getting comfortable, he'd take off his shoes, put them up on the table, he'd take down a six-pack of beer, he'd open it up, he'd start telling the kids stories. One night, the father comes in, and he overhears one of the stories, and then he's saying, space to enjoy. He wants kids to hear a story like that. Tell himself, I'm going to say something tomorrow. I don't want to talk with that kind of kids. But, you know, it's a little embarrassed, how can you say it, you know, they get insulted, you know, so you let it go. A few days later, we see that bringing out some publications from the dad who, I was going to say this, he doesn't want the kids to see that, no way. But again, he's hesitant, you know, they have a relationship with this part for many years, and the kids are just, they don't hear. He's asking kids, go do your homework, they don't even hear what he's saying. They're just influenced, they're just taking him in. In desperation, again, he leaves his home, he goes back to shoot, and he goes to his wife, and he says, well, I said, you've got to have to sit down with me. I have an emergency. I said, what's wrong? He tells him all this story. And God, I said, no, I'm going to try to help you out. But I don't understand something. Where did you make such a mistake to bring him into your house to begin with? How do you bring someone like that into your house? Didn't you realize something like this might happen? That guy that the Hebrew did, a lot of us have lived into our house. When we invite the outside world, and we allow them to infiltrate our Rishis HaYotid to bring the way into our house. Sometimes we bring the way, it's harmless, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's good, it's a free babysitter. It helps the house is quiet, more serene. Sometimes my wife tells me she thinks of bringing something to dad in the house just to get the kids in one spot for a few minutes. But then sometimes, when we're not looking, all of a sudden the topics change. And it's not exactly what we want our children to listen to. Not exactly what we want our children to hear. If you want to fight the battle of the Hashemari, the battle is important, the power is just another. If you close up those crutches, close up those holes, seal our Shisayori, and if we don't open it up again, that's only when we're going to let out Kedusha from the outside world. Our hope to the outside has to be the hope that if you outline the Beis Hamikdash's windows, we're not made to allow light in from outside. The in shape of the way where they left the light of the Hashemish out to the world. Beis Yisrael, our homes, are each one of the refresh. And our homes have to be a place where they generate in shape of the world. Not Chas Hashem, they bring in the darkness. There's another interesting Chazal in Bereish Yisrael. Chazal said, Kisvu Lachem, that the Yevon told Ben Yisrael to write on Keren Shor of all places, on the horns of their oxen, Ein Michelech Tal Kei Yisrael. Right on the horns of their oxen, I have no portion of my own land in the God of Israel. And again here, the Kei Yisrael is stressed. I have no connection between me and God. God is not my God. God is universal. Religion is all universal. Culture is universal. It's Jewish, it's Hellenist, but it's all one the same family. What's the purpose of writing on the Kevin Shore? Why is that the place to write it? And I heard a beautiful shot, I forget the name of the Rav Neiman, who said that he was taking a tour of the British Museum. And he saw artifacts from that era when the Greeks were occupying the Yisrael. And he saw an interesting thing. There were no baby bottles in those days. How did the mothers feed their children milk? They would take milk and put it into the horn of a cow. They drill a hole through the horn of a cow and it was used as a little baby's bottle. This is what he said over. And so he explained that the Rebbe asked us to write on that baby's bottle, any chelot on Yisrael. The Rebbe knew that they are to be victorious in their fight against Klal Yisrael, they have to begin with the children of Klal Yisrael. Even to the youth, the youngest children, ingrain them with that Hellenistic view of life. And the fight of the Kashmir is the fight of the Hanukkah. As the Moshe Feinstein said inside of the brother said, the word Hanukkah comes from the word Chinuch. Hanukkah is a time to strengthen Chinuch Havana, to strengthen the training of our children. One Shabbos after Beit Hamidrash tells us, "Harodim b'ner havivon b'bonim tamidah hakhanim." Someone who's rogel, who does it on a regular basis, the mitzvah of ner, he will be zayzer tapshut mo tamidah hakhanim. So Rashi says, "What does that mean? Harodim b'ner?" Says Rashi, it's referring to ner Hanukkah, b'ner Shabbos. Of course, we're all familiar with the very famous minig. Widespread meaning in Klal Yisrael, that women are miskalelas at the time when they light the Shabbos lich, the children will be tamid chacham. Based on this gemara, Harov u'bener havinon b'nim tamid chacham. I heard a word recently in the name of the Sadeh Merot and the Sadeh Merotah, Rav Sekula, may not be that well known outside of Borbar. My father, for a little shtar sign, was installed by his shul, Mr. a year ago. His son told me over a word from his father. His father asked, "Harogel b'ner, how was it shy to be rogel b'ner Hanukkah? Ner Shabbos is something that comes up every week. You could say harogel b'ner if someone constantly lights the neighbors of Shabbos. They're makbid, or he shows makbedes to light every Shabbos, every Friday night. So she's learning that they're children that are coming. But how is one to do rogel on a mitzvah that only comes around once a year for 8 days?" And he said as follows. Very famous Svazemis. Svazemis asks, and it's brought by others as well. We know Chazal say, "Tumro butchro b'tzivu." In a case, for instance, when most of Claudius are the Snavei, we allow for things to be brought into the Beis Hamikdash, even the Tumro. Even though things are defiled, very famous halacha in the Karban Pesach. If most of Klal Yisrael is tamei, you're allowed to bring the Karban Pesach to Tumah. And so, the very famous question is asked, why is it that on Hanukkah we needed the nest that oil that is tar should be found? Why couldn't the oil be used in a survey? If everything was defiled by the Yevanim, so we could have lit the Hanukkah, the menorah of the Beis Hamikdash with defiled oil. It's fine, Tumah, which would see more. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu have to make such a miracle that the oil was found to begin with and lasted for 8 days? Says the Chiddush HaRim, it's true. If the Beis HaMikdash is functioning as it always does, the Kedusha of the Tahara, then if by chance something becomes Tameh, well, most of Klai Yisrael becomes Tameh, is a heter too much of the Sinai. But when we are beginning, we're rededicating the Beis HaMikdash. We make the Chanukah Sabayis, the Chanukah Samishbeach. We're starting fresh all over. The Yavon has defiled everything. We're trying to start afresh, start anew. At this moment, there's no heter to too much of the Sinai. Now we need things to be the Kedusha of the Tahara, in a state of purity. There's no heterim, there's no Tumah Hutra, you can't push aside, you can't be lenient when it comes to chinuch. And Rashi, Chumash says, the Pasuk Vayorek as Chanicha, when Avram was Mezaris, those that he trained, and he gathered together an army to fight against the four Malachim, Rashi says, what's the Lashon of Chanicha? Rashi says, chinuch. It comes from the Shirish, the root of the word chinuch, which is to start. As in the words Chanoich Lunar Alpidarka, as in the words Chanukah Samizbeach, as in the words Chanukah Sabayis. The Tzad of the Rav said that Rashi is not just picking three things that happen to be the word chinuch. Rashi is making a hekesh. There's a hekesh between, we have to compare the Chanukah Samizbeach, the rededication of the Mizbeach, the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash, and the training of our children. Just as when it comes to Chanukah Samizbeach, there is no room for any tumah at all, so too in the training of our children, there's no room for any tumah. There's no place for meaning. And that's what the Gemara is telling us. Harogu b'ner, if someone is rogu with this lesson of the Ner Chanukah, one lesson of Ner Chanukah, that there's no room for leniencies in the training of our children. When we are mechanech our children, we train them, we mechanech them in purity. We don't allow any of the defilement of the society to enter into our homes. Then someone who's rogu with that lesson is guaranteed that his children will become chachamim. And so our battle is to create a reshus hayachid of kedusha, to create a home that's a bastion of kedusha v'tahara, that's a fortress against the darkness that surrounds us. Are we doing that? Are we creating that? Is Klal Yisrael winning? I thought to myself, I would open up books and read up statistics. The little bit that I know already tells me I shouldn't read up much further because it's going to be very depressing to read. 52% intermarriage rate in America. Obviously something is going wrong. We have not built enough bastions of Kedusha. Then I reminded myself of what Yisrael Salanter said. He said when he was a young man, he was all energetic, and he was optimistic about life. He said to himself, I plan on changing the world around. I'm going to change the world. I'm going to add Kedusha to the entire world. And he got a little older. He realized, one man can't just turn over the world. I'll be happy if I can turn over my own city, the city of Salam. He got a little older and more mature. He said, if I can just take care of myself, I'll consider myself victorious. Are we winning? That's not a question for us to answer for all the bodies, though. We have to answer it on a personal basis. So I was thinking, I heard a story recently which I told myself I must share with you. I think that in a general way, really, if we want to talk about is Klal Yisrael winning? On the one hand, like I said, 52% intermarriage rate. On the other hand, every single one of us has at least one, two, three, maybe more acquaintances who we know are going to be children. We know that there's a turn, the tide is turning the other way. I heard a story recently which was so analogous of the maximum of Klal Yisrael, I felt I had to share it with you. There's a fellow who davened in the shul, where I don't know about he davened in that same shul. And the Rav of the shul told me over the story, this person told him, he personally saw. He was visiting a cousin of his in Eretz Yisrael. And one day his cousin of his says, I'd like you to come with me, I'm going to court today. I'd like you to come with me to court. The fellow knows that this cousin of Eretz Yisrael was a pity person. He said, what kind of court are you going to do? In the basement of court. He says, I'm going to a secular court. So what are you doing in a secular court? look, you can trust me, I'm not going, I'm not doing something wrong. I want you to come, I don't want to tell you what it's about. I want you to see for yourself what's going on. And what this person saw in the court was a problem. Actually, it's a topic which is on our minds now because the story of Shai Fima, that boy from New Jersey, was, so to speak, kidnapped by a rabbi in Muncie. You know, that's a sensational case going on here in New York. And the same type of case is being decided by an Israeli Supreme Court. This cousin, this Rabbi Gedalia, who lives in New York, had a son. His son was young, not learning in credit. And somehow or other, it's the detail that I don't know, he met a young boy, a teenager, an 18-year-old, who was the epitome of Israeli modern secular culture. He went with hair down to his chest. He was on the drugs. He was the drugs of society. And this young man somehow coupled up with a fellow, I don't know where he met him exactly. They began to talk to him and part Yiddish hearts that the boy had. And he opened up his heart a little bit and the boy became interested. And it didn't take much longer. The fellow turned over to him. This is already a number of years later, 3 or 4 years later. The boy could be looked at as the path for the man that was learning in yeshivas since he was a young boy. And the court case that was going on was just like what was going on in New York. The boy was saying, I was 18 years old when I decided to become religious. 18 years old! I could fight for my country at 18. Can't I make my own decisions? It was my decision I wanted to become religious. And the young man got up on the witness stand. And he also testified, I didn't brainwash him, I didn't coerce him, I spoke to him about the beauty of Torah, and he drank it thirstily. You starved him, you never gave him anything that could be called spiritual. When he heard what I had to offer, what Torah had to offer, he dove into it, he became frum. I didn't force him into it, it wasn't kidnapping, it wasn't brainwashing. And the fathers called up to the stand. The father began to cry in front of the people in the court. He said, my son, I gave him everything. I gave him everything. We're a wealthy family. He had his own car. He was in college. Whatever he wanted, he had. Look at him now. What have they done to him? They've ruined his life. He's brainwashed. He's living with the darkness. He has nothing to live with. He'll never make a living in his life. He's living in the medieval times. Look what they've done to him. I beg the court to have mercy on a father and return his son to him. And the defense lawyer was in the court, the prosecutors, they went back and forth. And finally, everyone had to say, and the judge stands up, and he says, I would like to address the court. The judge wants to speak. I call the father of the son, father of the boy, please come back up to the witness. He looks going on. He looks at the man, he says, your name is Mr. Well, he has some Israeli Hebrew name? He says, yes. I want to know something. Is that the name you were born with? No. Your name was such and such, gave the leadership, your patient name. He says, yeah, I wasn't. You came from such and such a place, such and such a town, didn't you? Yeah. Your father had this type of business, didn't he? Your mother was a tzaddikas. How do you know these things? I'm from that same city. I remember you as a young man. And I remember the day that you spit your father in the face and turned away from your home and became religious. The whole city turned upside down. The first Chagal Shabbos and Shut. We'll never forget it. I wouldn't forget your face. And throughout my life, I wouldn't forget your face. I remember your mother crying and walking down the street, back and forth, stopping everyone on the street, hysterically. She'd ask people, what did I do to deserve this? Every Friday by mass, she said, I would dabble by my candles. I would bet by Spider and I should have children. Weird, I go wrong. Why did this happen to me? 3 weeks after you left your home, she was depressed. Your father couldn't walk out of the house. He just stayed in the house for the rest of his life. And I remember.
remember what you had told people when they asked you, how did you destroy your family? I remember what you said. You said, I'm 18 years old. I can make my own decisions in life.
You're coming to my court, and you're saying that your son is not old enough to make his own decisions.
We wondered then what happened to your mother's tears. Now we know what happened to them.
Your son came back. That's what happened to your mother's tears. And now take your court case and get out of my court. I can't judge your case. This is clear reason. I heard it from the man who heard it from the person who was there at the court case. So are we women? It's a hard thing to say. We lost the father, the son is returning back. If anyone wondered what happened to those tears, they brought back the grandchildren, the grandson. The Bach, and Rabbi Rosenblatt quoted to us, tells us that the terrible inroads that the one made in finally by Beis HaMikdash came because we were in Russia, because we weakened our avodah. We didn't understand, we didn't appreciate the benefits of the Beis HaMikdash. And when someone doesn't appreciate something enough, then sometimes the Rebbe says, if you don't appreciate it, I'll take it away from you. So says the Bach, when the Kashtanoim came, and they were moist in Nefesh with that very same Avodah, the others had not grabbed onto, they were moist in Nefesh with that Avodah. And because of that, Russian saw Mr. Asnefesh, but he had going to the next Amikdash. All the miracles took place. And once again, the Zaytra, and the Nisim of the Beis Amikdash returned to us. Maybe none of us here, in fact, all the clients saw their record. Our battle is a personal one. Are we winning? That's a question each one of us has to answer for himself or for herself. It's up to us to win our own battle. At the end of the short story that I heard in the early 1948, when the state of Israel was first created. So the Israeli army was very sorely underarmed. And they couldn't even afford ammunition to the trainees. They would march back and forth with wooden broomsticks or pieces of wood carved out in shapes of rifles for lack of anything better to train them with. They came to a point where those that were guarding the kibbutzim, they were not mamish on the borders, they also, their guns were taken away from them and given to those that were on the front lines. And so the Rabbi found himself guarding a kibbutz with a wooden stick on his shoulder, marching back and forth. And all of a sudden, one night, as he's standing guard, he's able to